Hello, and welcome to the Dark Cryptids Podcast. I am your host, Devin Bloodworth. And the things that we discuss on this podcast include, but are not limited to, cryptids, paranormal encounters, dark history, and urban legends. I hope you enjoy this podcast. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Hello, hello, everyone, and welcome back. I know it's been a little bit since I've done an episode. Excuse me. So I apologize about that, I really do. But I'm willing to kind of give an explanation. So, the month of December has been pretty chaotic for me. One of the big things that's happened in my life is I've changed jobs. I'm now working at Amazon full-time, and with that came a lot of changes to my schedule, and as well with the holidays, that's been pretty chaotic as well. It's been a good December, it's been a good month, but, you know, it's just been chaotic. And I'm glad to put this episode out on the first of the year. Go ahead and get the year going on the right foot. So, I apologize again to anyone that's been waiting for me. I'm not dead. I'm here. I'm alive. But today I kind of figured, since we're coming back, let's make this episode a good one. So, I figured I'd finally get around to telling the story of the Russian Sleep Experiment Project. I've been kind of holding back on it. That's kind of been in my back pocket for a little bit now, because I wasn't sure when the right time would be to go ahead and talk about that one. But I figure, hey, I took a long enough break here. Let's go ahead and push out a good episode, a good story for everyone. I'm really glad to see that since I've been gone, I actually still have a very active community going on, not in the sense of getting questions and all that other kind of stuff, but in the sense of my viewership didn't take too much of a hit, so I really do appreciate everyone that's been sticking around and watching the episodes. Now, something I want to go ahead and talk about too before we finally start this episode. And this is the last thing, and then we'll go ahead and get right into it. With me being back into this, I don't want to make any false promises to anyone that I'm going to continue to push out a podcast every 2 weeks. So, unfortunately, with my new job, it does take a lot more out of me than my previous one did. So, that's kind of been the reason why I haven't really been pushing out episodes as much. But I promise I'm not going to forget about this podcast. I am going to push out episodes here and there. It might be once a month, it might be twice a month, but I am going to continue to push out episodes. But without any further ado, the Russian Sleep Experiment. Now, I wish I could credit an author on this. However, this one is so old that it's been around since I was in middle school, about 10, 12 years ago. So it's kind of impossible to trace back the original author of it. And just a disclaimer, there are a lot of things in here that aren't realistic, but not all creepy stories are going to be realistic. But okay, let's get into it. Russian researchers in the late 1940s kept five people awake for 15 days using an experimental gas-based stimulant. They were kept in a sealed environment to carefully monitor their oxygen intake so the gas didn't kill them, since it was toxic in high concentrations. This was before closed-circuit cameras, so they only had microphones and 5-inch thick glass porthole-sized windows into the chamber to monitor them. The chamber was stocked with books, cots to sleep on, but no bedding, running water, and a toilet, and enough dried food to last all five for over a month. The test subjects were political prisoners deemed enemies of the state during World War II. Everything was fine for the first 5 days. The subjects hardly complained, having been promised falsely that they would be freed if they submitted to the test, and did not sleep for 30 days. Their conversations and activities were monitored, and it was noted that they continued to talk about increasingly traumatic incidents in their past, and a general tone of their conversations took on a darker aspect after the 4-day mark. After 5 days, they started to complain about the circumstances and events that led them to where they were and started to demonstrate severe paranoia. They stopped talking to each other and began alternatively whispering to the microphones and one-way mirrored portholes. Oddly, they all seemed to think they could win the trust of the experimenters by turning over their comrades, the other subjects in captivity with them. At first, researchers suspected this was an effect of the gas itself. After 9 days, the first of them started screaming. He ran the length of the chamber repeatedly, yelling at the top of his lungs for 3 hours straight. He continued attempting to scream, but was only able to produce occasional squeaks. The researchers postulated that he had physically torn his vocal cords. The most surprising thing about this behavior is how the other captives reacted to it, or rather, didn't react to it. They continued whispering to the microphones until the second of the captives started to scream. The two non-screaming captives took the books apart, smeared page after page with their own feces, and pasted them calmly over the glass portholes. The screaming promptly stopped. So did the whispering to the microphones. After 3 more days passed, the researchers checked the microphones hourly to make sure they were working, since they thought it impossible that no sound could be coming with 5 people inside. The oxygen consumption in the chamber indicated that all 5 must still be alive. In fact, it was the amount of oxygen 5 people would consume at a very heavy level of strenuous exercise. On the morning of the 14th day, the researchers did something they said they would not do to get a reaction from the captives. They used the intercom inside the chamber, hoping to provoke any response from the captives. They were afraid were either dead or vegetables. They announced, "We are opening the chamber to test the microphones. Step away from the door and lie flat on the floor or you will be shot. Compliance will earn one of you your immediate freedom." To their surprise, they heard a single phrase in a calm voice response. "We no longer want to be freed." Debate broke out among the researchers and the military forces funding the research. Unable to provoke any more response using the intercom, it was finally decided to open a chamber at midnight on the 15th day. The chamber was flushed of the stimulant gas and filled with fresh air, and immediately voices from the microphones began to object. 3 different voices began begging, as if pleading for the life of loved ones to turn the gas back on. The chamber was open, and soldiers sent in to retrieve the test subjects. They began to scream louder than ever, and so did the soldiers when they saw what was inside. 4 of the 5 subjects were still alive, although no one could rightly call the state that any of them in life. The food rations past day 5 had not been so much as touched. There were chunks of meat from the dead test subjects' thighs and chest stuffed into the drain in the center of the chamber, locking the drain and allowing 4 inches of water to accumulate on the floor. Precisely how much of the water on the floor was actually blood was never determined. All 4 surviving test subjects also had large portions of muscle and skin torn away from their bodies. The destruction of flesh and exposed bone on their fingertips indicated that the wounds were inflicted by hand, not with teeth as the researchers initially thought. closer examination of the position and angles of the wounds indicated that most, if not all of them, were self-inflicted. The abdomen organs below the rib cage of all four test subjects had been removed. While the heart, lungs, and diaphragm remained in place, the skin and most of the muscles attached to the ribs had been ripped off, exposing the lungs through the rib cage. All the blood vessels and organs remained intact. They had just been taken out and laid on the floor, fanning out around the eviscerated but still living bodies of the subjects. The digestive tract of all four could be seen to be working, digesting food. It quickly became apparent that what they were digesting was their own flesh that they had ripped off and eaten over the course of days. Most of the soldiers were Russian special operatives at the facility, but still many refused to return to the chamber to remove the test subjects. They continued to scream to be left in the chamber, and alternately begged and demanded that the gas be turned back on, lest they fall asleep. To everyone's surprise, the test subjects put up a fierce fight in the process of being removed from the chamber. One of the Russian soldiers died from having his throat ripped out. Another was gravely injured by having his testicles ripped off and an artery in his leg severed by one of the subject's teeth. Another five of the soldiers lost their lives, if you count the ones that committed suicide in the weeks following the incident. In the struggle, one of the four living subjects had his spleen ruptured, and he bled out almost immediately. The medical researchers attempted to sedate him, but this proved impossible. He was injected with more than 10 times the human dose of a morphine derivative and still fought like a cornered animal, breaking the ribs and arm of one doctor. When his heart was seen to beat for a full 2 minutes after he had bled out, to the point there is more air in his vascular system than blood. Even after it stopped, he continued to scream and flail for another 3 minutes, struggling to attack anyone in reach, and just repeating the word more over and over, weaker and weaker, until he finally fell silent. The surviving three test subjects were heavily restrained and moved to a medical facility. The two with intact vocal cords continuously begging for the gas, demanding to be kept awake. Well, we are about halfway through the story here, so we're going to go ahead and take a short ad break. Don't worry, the ad's only 20 seconds, maybe 30 seconds long at most, but we'll be right back, everyone. Alright, and we are back. I promised you guys an ad break would be short, and I hope it was for you. But let's go ahead and get right back into the rest of this. The most injured of the three was taken to the only surgical operating room that the facility had. In the process of preparing the subject to have his organs placed back within his body, it was found that he was effectively immune to the sedative that they had given him to prepare him for the surgery. He fought furiously against his restraints when an anesthetic gas was brought out to put him under. He managed to tear most of the way through a 4-inch wide leather strap on one wrist, even through the weight of a 200-pound soldier holding that wrist as well. It took only a little more anesthetic than normal to put him under. In an instant, his eyelids fluttered and closed, his heart stopped. In the autopsy of the test subject that died on the operating table, it was found that his blood had tripled a normal level of oxygen. His muscles that were still attached to his skeleton were badly torn, and he had broken 9 bones in a struggle to not be subdued. Most of them were from the force his own muscles had exerted on them. The second survivor had been the first of the group of five to start screaming. His vocal cords destroyed, he was unable to beg or object to surgery, and he only reacted by shaking his head violently in disapproval when an anesthetic gas was brought near him. He shook his head yes when someone suggested, reluctantly, They tried a surgery without anesthetic and did not react for the entire 6-hour procedure of replacing his abdominal organs and attempting to cover them with what remained of his skin. The surgeon presiding stated repeatedly that it should be medically possible for the patient to still be alive. Medically impossible, that was a typo. One terrified nurse assisting the surgery stated that she had seen the patient's mouth curl into a smile several times whenever his eyes met hers. When the surgery ended, the subject looked at the surgeon and began to wheeze loudly, attempting to talk while struggling. Assuming this must be something of drastic importance, the surgeon had a pen and pad fetched so the patient could write his message. It was simple. Keep cutting. The other two test subjects were given the same surgery, both without anesthetic as well. Although they had to be injected with a paralytic for the duration of operation. The surgeon found it impossible to perform the operation while the patients laughed continuously. Once paralyzed, the subjects could only follow the intending researchers with their eyes. The paralytic cleared the system in an abnormally short period of time, and they were soon trying to escape their bonds. The moment they could speak, they were again asking for the stimulant gas. The researchers tried asking why they had injured themselves, why they had ripped out their own guts, and why they wanted to be given the gas again. Only one response was given: I must remain awake. All three subjects' restraints were reinforced, and they were placed back into the chamber, awaiting determination as to what should be done with them. The researchers, facing the wrath of their military benefactors for having failed the stated goals of their project, considered euthanizing the surviving subjects. The commanding officer, an ex-KGB, instead saw potential and wanted to see what would happen if they were put back on the gas. The researchers strongly objected, but were overruled. In preparation for being sealed in the chamber again, the subjects were connected to an EEG monitor and had their restraints padded for long-term confinement. To everyone's surprise, all three stopped struggling the moment it was let slip that they were going back on the gas. It was obvious that at this point, all three were putting up a great struggle to stay awake. One of the subjects that could speak was humming loudly and continuously. The mute subject was straining his legs against the leather bonds with all his might. First left, then right, then left again, for something to focus on. The remaining subject was holding his head off his pillow and blinking rapidly. Having been the first to be wired for EEG, most of the researchers were monitoring his brainwaves in surprise. They were normal most of the time, but sometimes flatlined inexplicably. It looked as if he were repeatedly suffering brain death before returning to normal. As they focused on paper scrolling out of the brainwave monitor, only one nurse saw his eyes slip shut at the same moment his head hit the pillow. His brainwaves immediately changed to that of dead sleep, then flatlined for the last time as his heart simultaneously stopped. The only remaining subject that could speak started screaming to be sealed in now. His brainwaves showed the same flatlines as one who had just died from falling asleep. The commander gave the order to seal the chamber with both subjects inside, as well as three researchers. One of the named three immediately drew his gun and shot the commander point blank between the eyes, then turned the gun on the mute subject and blew his brains out as well. He pointed his gun at the remaining subject, still restrained to a bed as the remaining members of the medical and research team fled the room. "I won't be locked in here at these stings. Not with you," he screamed at the man strapped to the table. "What are you?" he demanded. "I must know." The subject smiled. "Have you forgotten so easily?" the subject asked. "We are you. We are the madness that lurks within you all, begging to be free at every moment in your deepest animal mind. We are what you hide from in your beds every night. We are what you sedate into silence and paralysis when you go to the nocturnal haven where we cannot tread. Fred. The researcher paused, then aimed at the subject's heart and fired. The EEG flatlined as the subject weakly choked out. So nearly free. Dang, it's been a while since I've read that one. I'm glad I was able to, go ahead and read that on the episode today because, you know, last time I read that, the full story of the Russian sleep experiment was probably when I was a lot younger. It's good to know it's still a good read. But, yeah, I don't know about you guys, but, you know, if you guys want to, let me know. The longest I've been awake for at any point in time was, I want to say 3-4 days. It was like 4 days. The first 2 days are, they suck. The third day really sucks. The fourth day, like you have trouble focusing your eyes. Like I started seeing stuff out the corner of my eyes. And my body was actually so tired by the fourth day that it was hard for me to go to sleep. Like, I remember I like rested my head and I don't remember when I fell asleep, but I know I stayed like that for a good hour or two. Like, you would think after 4 days of being awake straight, like, I would just fall asleep, but no, my body wouldn't let me go to sleep for a good little bit. But yeah, I don't think that this is real, because, you know, it's a work of fiction, but I do fully believe that after staying awake for so long, you would go insane, because if I was, like, seeing stuff and hearing things, on just 4 days of being awake, I couldn't imagine being awake for, 15 days, I think, is how long they made it before they, you know, they passed. But yeah, sleep deprivation is definitely like one of the subjects that like interests me for sure. But I don't want to end the episode here because that was like 21 minutes. Let me see what else there is on here. Because I'm on a Moon Conspiracy website. It's got some good stuff. I'm going to include that link in the episode description. It's got some pretty interesting stuff. You know what? We're going to read out one more creepypasta before we end the story. This one is also a pretty old one. Oh, is it? This one's a long one, though. This one. I guess I could go ahead and read this one out. This one's also an old one from when I was younger. Whenever, like, I don't know if you guys are like me, but, like, you know, when I was younger, I loved creepypasta. I loved, like, reading creepy stuff. Like, I love shit like that. It absolutely fascinated me. It made for a lot of sleepless nights, but it fascinated me. But I'm just kind of thinking this, because this is going to be about, this next story is going to be about a 23-minute read time. And I'm kind of thinking maybe I should save it for another episode and read a shorter creepypasta. Toby. Let's see what else I can find here real quick. You know what, I think I found another one that should be a little shorter, hopefully. Yeah, this one's shorter. I'm okay with reading this one real quick. Right, so this next creepypasta we're gonna read. And it's gonna be the last one for tonight, and then we'll go ahead and end the episode and shout out which areas have the most listener support. Right, let's get into this. This next and last creepypasta for the episode. It's an old one. Some of you might not even recognize it. It's called Ticky Toby. The long road home seemed to go on and on. The road continued to stretch in front of the vehicle endlessly. The light that shone through the branches of the tall green trees danced across the window in random patterns, and every once in a while, obnoxiously shining in your eyes. The surroundings were full of deep green trees forming a forest around the road. The only sound was the sound of the car's engine as it traveled down the path. It was peaceful and left a serene feeling. Although the ride seemed like a nice one, it lacked every form of nice from its two passengers. The middle-aged woman behind the steering wheel had neat, short brown hair that fit her complexion quite well. She wore a green V-neck t-shirt and a pair of blue jeans. Diamond stud earrings decorated each of her ears, which partially showed from behind her haircut. She had deep green eyes, which her shirt brought out, and the lighting seemed to make them more noticeable. There wasn't anything significant about her appearance. She looked like any other average mother you would see on TV shows and the like. However, the one thing that made her different than the average mothers was a dark bag she had under her eyes. Her facial expression was gloomy and sad, although she genuinely looked like someone who smiled a lot. She would sniffle every once in a while and occasionally glance in the rearview mirror to look at her son in the back seat, who was hunched over partially, with his arms held tight around his chest, his head pressed against a cold window. The boy lacked any normal appearance, and anyone could plainly see there was something wrong with him. His messy brown hair went every which way, and the luminescent lighting brought out his pale, almost gray skin. His eyes were dark, unlike his mother's, and he wore a white t-shirt and scrub pants that had been provided for him by the hospital. The clothes he had worn before were so shredded and blood-stained that they weren't wearable anymore. The right side of his face bared a few cuts, along with a split eyebrow. His right arm was bandaged all the way to the shoulder, which had been shredded when his right side hit the shattered glass. His injuries appeared to be painful, when in reality he couldn't feel anything. This was just one of the glories of being him. One of the challenges he had to face while growing up was growing up with a rare disease that caused him to be completely numb towards pain. Never before had he felt himself get hurt. He could have lost an arm and felt nothing. The other major disorder he had faced, which was the one that deemed him many insulting nicknames in the short time he attended grade school before he switched to homeschooling, was his Tourette syndrome, which caused him to tic and twitch in ways he couldn't control. He would crack his neck uncontrollably and twitch every once in a while. The kids would tease him and call him Ticky Toby, and they mocked him with exaggerating twitching and laughing. It got so bad he had to turn to homeschooling. It was too hard for him to be in a common learning environment with seemingly every kid poking, or more like stabbing, fun at him. Toby stared blankly out the window, his face empty of any emotion, and every few minutes his shoulder, arm, or foot would twitch. Every bump that the car tires hit would make his stomach turn. Toby Rogers was a boy's name, and the last time Toby remembered riding in a car was when it crashed. That's all he thought about, unconsciously replaying everything he remembered before he blacked out, over and over again. Toby had been a lucky one. His sister had not been so lucky. When the thought of sister came, he couldn't help the tears that welled up in his eyes. The horrible memories replayed in his mind. Her screaming that had cut off when the front of the car was smashed in. It all went blank for a moment before Toby opened his eyes to see his sister's body, her forehead pierced with glass shards, her hips and legs crushed under the force of the steering wheel, and her torso pushed in from the too late inflated airbag. That was the last thing he had seen of his dear older sister. The road home continued on for what seemed like forever. It took so long to get home because his mom wanted to avoid the sight of the crash. When the surroundings gave way to a familiar neighborhood, they were both more than ready to get out of the car and step back into their own home. It was an older neighborhood with quaint little houses all next to each other. The car drove in front of a blue house with white window panes. They both quickly noticed the old vehicle that was parked in front of the house, and the familiar figure that stood in the driveway. Toby felt automatic anger and frustration take over him at the sight of his father who wasn't there. His mother pulled the car up in the driveway beside him before turning off the engine and preparing to step out and face her husband. "Why is he here?" Toby said quietly, as he looked back at his mother who reached to open the car door. "He's your father, Toby. He's here because he wants to see you." His mother responded in a monotone voice, trying to sound less shaky. Yet, couldn't drive up to the hospital to see Laura before she died. Toby narrowed his eyes out the window. "He was drunk that night, honey. He couldn't drive." "Yeah, when is he not?" Toby pushed the door open before his mother and stumbled out onto the driveway, where he met his father's gaze before looking down at his feet with a stern expression. His mother stepped out behind him and met her husband's eyes before walking around the car. His father opened up his arms, expecting a hug from his wife, but she walked past him and put her arm around Toby's shoulder and started leading him inside. "Connie," her husband began in a raspy voice. "What, no welcome home hug, huh?" She ignored her husband's obnoxious words and walked past him with her son under her arm. "Hey, he's 16, he can walk by himself." His father began to follow them in. "He's 17. Connie glared back at him before opening the door to the house and stepping inside. "Toby, why don't we get you in your room to rest, okay? I'll come get you when dinner is ready." "No, I'm 16, I can walk by myself," Toby said sarcastically, and glared back at his father before stumbling up the small staircase and turning into his room, where he slammed the door violently. His little room didn't have much in it, just a small bed, a dresser, and a window. And his walls had a few picture frames of his family, back when they were a family, before his father became an alcoholic and acted violently towards the rest of his family. Toby remembered when he was arguing with his mom, and he grabbed her by the hair and shoved her to the floor. And when Laura had tried to break it up, he pushed her and she hit her back on a corner of the kitchen counter. Toby could never forgive him for what he did to his mother and sister. Never. Toby didn't care how much his father beat him down. He couldn't feel it anyway. What he did care about was how he intentionally hurt the only two people he cared about. And when he was waiting in the hospital where his sister took her last breaths, the only one who didn't rush there was his dad. Toby stood by the window and looked out at the street. He could have sworn he saw something out of the corner of his eye, but quickly blamed it on the meds he was on. When dinner time had come and his mother called up to him, Toby came downstairs and hesitantly sat down at the table across from his father and in between his mother and an empty chair. It was quiet as his parents picked up their food, but Toby refused to eat. Instead, he just watched his dad with a blank stare. His mother caught on to his staring and elbowed him slightly. Toby looked over at her slightly and then down at his uneaten food, which he still didn't touch. Toby laid in bed. He pulled his covers over his head and stared at the window. He was tired, but there was no way he would fall asleep. He couldn't, There's too much to think about. He had been debating on whether or not to follow his mother's directions and forgive his father, or continue holding a grudge with his boiling hatred. He heard his door creak open, and his mother padded into the room and sat on the bed next to him. She reached over and rubbed his back, which had been turned to her. "I know it's hard, Toby. Trust me, I understand. But I promise you it will get better," she said softly. "When is he going to leave?" Toby said with an innocent tone in his shaky voice. Connie let her gaze fall down to her feet. "I don't know, honey. He's staying as far as I know," she replied. Toby didn't respond. He just continued to look forward at the wall, holding his damaged arm near his chest. After a few minutes of silence, his mother sighed before she leaned in to kiss his cheek and stood up to walk out of the room. "Good night," she said as she closed the door. The hours passed slowly, and Toby couldn't quit tossing and turning. Every time he let his imagination take over, he heard the screeching of tires, the screaming of his sister, and he would uncontrollably jerk in bed. He threw off his cover, and lying on his back, he pulled his pillow over his face and cried into it. He could hear his own pitiful weeping. He would have been screaming and crying if he didn't press his pillow over his face. After a few seconds, he threw the pillow off his face and sat up, hunched over, holding his head and breathing roughly, tears streaming from his eyes. He couldn't help but cry. He tried to keep it in, but he couldn't stop the whining and whimpering as he sat there shaking. He inhaled before he stood up and walked around his bed to the window and peered out, taking deep breaths, trying to calm down. He rubbed his eyes and looked out at the group of tall pine trees across the street. He stopped suddenly, and his gaze slowly centered on something standing under the streetlight. He heard ringing in his ears and couldn't look away. The figure stood beside the streetlight, about 2 feet shorter than it did, long arms draped at its side as it stared up at him with non-existing eyes. The figure had no facial features to speak of. No eyes, no mouth, no nose. Yet it held Toby's hypnotized stare, seemingly peering into his very being. The ringing in his ears grew louder and louder each second he stared before suddenly it all went black. The next morning, Toby woke in his bed. He felt different. He wasn't tired at all, and when he consciously woke up, it felt like he had been lying there awake for hours. He had no thoughts flowing through his mind. He sat up slowly and stumbled over to the wall, but when he stood, he automatically felt dizzy. He stumbled to the doorway and walked down the stairs. His parents were sitting at the table. His father was tuned into the small TV that sat on the countertop, and his mother was reading the newspaper. She quickly looked over when she felt Toby's presence looming behind her. "Well, good morning, sleepyhead. You've been sleeping forever," she greeted him with a hesitant smile. Toby slowly looked over at the clock and noticed that it was 12:30. "I made you breakfast, but it got cold. I was going to wake you, but I felt you needed sleep." Her expression fell from happy to worried as her son resisted responding to her. "Are you all right?" Toby stumbled over and sat by his father. He felt as if he was on idle and had no control over his reactions, over his actions. He was seeing everything he did, but it didn't register in his brain properly. He reached out to his father's arm, but his hand ended up getting slapped. His father turned to him abruptly and pushed his chair over with his foot. "Don't touch me, boy," he yelled. His mother stood up. "All right, knock that off. That is the last thing we need." The days went by and things continued on as they were. Connie spent most of her time cleaning the house, and her rude husband spent most of his time ordering her around. It was just like how it used to be before the crash. Toby never really left his room. He would sit by his bed and tremble. His mind would wonder, wander, but his thoughts changed too fast to be remembered. He would pace around his small room like a caged animal or stare out the window. The unhealthy cycle continued. Connie continued to be pushed around by her husband, being way too submissive to him, and Toby remained in his room. Before he could think twice, he would begin to chew on his hands, tearing the flesh from his fingers. He would gnaw his hands until they bled. When his mother walked in on him while he was doing so, she reacted horribly. She rushed him downstairs and grabbed the first aid kit, wrapping his hands in bandages. Afterward, she demanded that he wouldn't leave her side again. Toby isolated himself so much that he grew to hate being around others. His memory grew glitchy as well. He'd start missing memory of minutes, hours, days, and so on. He would begin talking nonsense about things completely unrelated to the conversations he would have. He'd go off about seeing things, sharks in the sink as he washed the dishes, hearing crickets in his pillows, and seeing ghosts outside his bedroom window. His mother grew so anxious about his mental health that she decided it would be good for him to talk to a professional about what he was feeling. Connie walked Toby into the building, holding his hand and guiding him in. She walked him up to the front desk and began talking to the lady who sat behind it. "Miss Rogers?" the lady asked. "Yes, that's me," Connie nodded. "We're here to see Dr. Oliver. I'm here with Toby Rogers." "Yes, right this way." The lady stood and led them down a long hallway. Toby looked at the framed artwork down the halls and tuned in to the sound of the lady's high heels on the hardwood floor. She opened a door to a room with a table and two chairs. "If we can get him to sit in here for a few minutes, I'll get the doctor," she smiled and held the door open. Toby stumbled into the room and sat down at the table. He looked over at his mother and a lady before the door slowly shut behind them. He looked up around the room before he held up his tightly bandaged hands, began to bite at the bandages to unwrap his hands. But he was interrupted as the door swung open and a young woman in a black and spotted dress with light blonde hair stepped in, holding a clipboard and a pen. "Toby," she asked with a smile. Toby looked up at her and nodded. "Nice to meet you, Toby. My name is Dr. Oliver." She put her hand out for him to shake, but hesitantly pulled away when she noticed his bandaged hands. "Oh," she smiled nervously before clearing her throat and sitting in a chair across the table from him. "So, I'm going to ask you a few questions. Try to answer them as honestly as possible, okay?" She placed her clipboard down on the table. Toby nodded slowly and held his restrained hands in his lap. "How old are you, Toby?" 17, he responded quietly. She wrote that down on the paper that was clipped to the clipboard. "What is your full name?" "Toby Aaron Rogers." "When is your birthday?" "April 28th. "Who is your immediate family?" Toby paused for a minute before answering her question. "My mom, my dad, and..." He stopped. "My sister." "I heard about your sister, dear. I'm really sorry." Her expression faded into a sad, pity-filled look. Toby nodded. "Do you remember anything from the crash, Toby?" Toby looked away from her. His mind went blank for a moment. He looked down at his lap and in the surrounding area. He heard a faint ringing sound. His eyes widened and he froze in place. "Toby?" the counselor asked. "Toby, are you listening?" Toby felt a shiver go down his spine until he froze once again and slowly looked over out the little window through the door where he saw it. A dark, featureless figure peering in at him. He stared, eyes widened, the ringing growing louder and louder until suddenly the loud voice of the counselor broke his trance. "Toby," she yelled. Toby jumped and fell sideways out of his chair and backed up into the corner. Dr. Oliver stood up, holding her clipboard to her chest, a surprised look in her eyes. Toby met her eyes again, his breath hitching as he twitched. That night, Toby lay in bed. His eyes were dazed as he stared straight up at his ceiling. He could feel himself begin to doze off when he heard the scattering of footsteps down his hallway. He sat up and looked towards the doorway, his door wide open. There was no light, everything was lit by the luminescent blue glow of the moon through his window, leaving a cold lighting. He stood up and slowly made his way toward the doorway, when suddenly, the door which previously was wide open, slammed in his face. He gasped and fell back. He was out of breath when he hit the ground, and he began breathing heavily, his eyes wide open. He waited for a few seconds before getting back on his feet. He reached out and grasped a cold door handle with his bandaged hand, and it creaked open. He looked out into the dark hallway and tiptoed out of his room. The window at the end of the hallway lit up the darkness with blue moonlight as he padded his way down. He could hear footsteps rustling around him, and faint giggling followed by the pitter-patter of small feet, which sounded like a child had run in front of him, giggling and running around. The hallway was a lot longer than he remembered. It seemed endless, like the ride home from the hospital. He heard the door creak in front of him. "Mom?" he called in a shaky voice. Suddenly, a door slammed behind him, and he jumped and turned around. Behind him, he heard a long, eerie groan that sounded like croaking right in his ear. He turned around as fast as he could. It was suddenly face to face with none other than his dead sister. Her eyes were clouded white, her skin pale, the right side of her jaw dangling there by tissue and muscle, glass protruding from her forehead, black blood leaking down her face, her blonde hair pulled up in a ponytail as it always was, and she was wearing her gray t-shirt and athlete shorts, which were dirty and spotted with blood. Her legs were bent in ways they shouldn't be. She stood emitting a long, croaking noise only an inch away from Toby's face. Toby yelped and fell back. "Ah!" He started to crawl backward away from her, but he was unable to break the eye contact he held with her blank, dead eyes. He dragged himself backward until he backed up into something. He stopped for a second. Everything was dead silent except for his heavy breathing and crying. He slowly looked up to meet the blank face of a tall, dark figure. The same figure that stood over him now. Behind the tall, dark mass were rows of children looking to range from 3 to 10 years old. Their eyes completely black, and dark black blood leaked from their eye sockets. He screamed and stood up as fast as he could, only to be tripped by dark black tendrils that wrapped around his ankle. He fell straight on his stomach and got the wind knocked out of him. He tried to scream, but he couldn't make a sound. He wheezed out before it all went black. Toby woke with a start. He screamed out and sat up as fast as he could, completely short of breath. He wheezed out and held his chest with his bandaged hands. It was just a dream, just a dream. He lay back down on his bed and rolled over on his side. It felt like weights had been lifted off his chest as he took in deep breaths. He stood up and padded over to his window. He saw nothing. Nobody was out there. No ghost, no figures, nothing. He heard the rustling and coughing of his father outside the doorway. His door was closed. He walked over and opened it. Looking out into the hallway once again, he walked down the hallway and into the kitchen where he found his dad standing and having a smoke in their living room. Toby waited for a second and watched him from around the corner before a burning feeling started deep in his chest. Deep boiling anger overtook him. He heard the little imaginary voices in his head. "Do it, do it, do it," they chanted. He turned away and held his arms, He felt like he actually had control over himself, unlike he did for the past few weeks since he got home from the hospital. He actually had complete thoughts for just moments before the chanting of the little voices in his head clouded them. Kill him. He wasn't there. He wasn't there. Kill him. Kill him. They continued on. Toby trembled. No. No, he wasn't going to do it. What, was he going crazy? No, he won't kill anyone. He can't. He hated his father, but there is no way he is going to kill him. That was it, the last thought he had before he fell into an idle state once again. The influence of the voices in his head was too much. He began to silently walk up behind his father. He reached over the counter to the knife in the case. He gripped it in his hand. He felt the sensation take over his chest. He let out a snicker. He began laughing so hard he had to gasp for breath. His father turned around abruptly before he felt a brute force shove him to the floor. He grunted as the air was knocked out of him. What? He looked up at the boy who stood over him, grasping the kitchen knife in his hand. Toby, what are you doing? He went to sit up and put his arms out in front of him in self-defense, but before he knew it, Toby was on top of him. He went to grab his neck, but his father reached out and blocked his hand by grabbing onto his wrist. Stop, get off me, you little fucker! He yelled, and with his other hand, he threw an off-center punch towards Toby's shoulder, but he didn't stop. The look in Toby's eyes was not sane. It looked as if a demon had taken control of him. He yelled back and went to stab the knife into his father's chest, but his father blocked him and grabbed onto his wrist once again. He went to shove him back, but Toby kicked his feet out in front of him and landed a hard blow straight to his father's face. His father recoiled and pulled his arms away to cuff his face, but Toby got back up and drove the knife straight into his shoulder. His father let out a loud cry and went to pull the knife out, but before he could, Toby threw his fist straight into his face. He began to pound his fists into his head, laughing and wheezing. He cracked his neck and grabbed the knife and ripped it out of his father's shoulder. He drove it deep into his dad's chest and repeatedly stabbed into his torso, blood spilling out and getting splattered everywhere. He didn't stop until his father's body went still. He threw the knife over to the side and leaned over his body, coughing and panting. He stared at his father's smashed-in face and sat there twitching until a loud scream broke the silence. He looked over to see his mother standing a few feet away, covering her mouth, tears streaming down her face. "Toby," she screamed. "Why did you do that?" she cried. "Why?" she screamed. Toby stood up and began to back away from his father's bloody corpse. He began to back out of the kitchen. He looked down at the blood-soaked bandages on his hands and looked up at his mother one last time before he turned and ran out of the house. He ran into the garage and slammed his hand against the control panel on the wall and pushed a button to open the garage door. Before he ran out, he noticed his father's hatchets, which had been hanging on the tool rack above a table full of jars filled to the brim with old rusted nails and screws. One of the hatchets was new. It had a bright orange handle and a shiny blade. And the other was old with a wooden handle and an old dull blade. He grabbed both and looked down at the table, and he saw a box of matches. And under the table was a red gasoline tank. He held both of the hatches in one hand and grabbed the matches and gasoline before running out of the garage, down the driveway, and up the street. As he approached a streetlight that he could see out his own bedroom window, he heard police sirens in the distance. He turned around and the red and blue flashing lights came rushing down the street. Toby stood for a second before he pulled open a cap on the gasoline tank and ran down the street, spilling gasoline all over the street after him. He turned and ran into the trees. He poured the last bit of gasoline out before he reached into his pocket and pulled out a match. He struck it against a box and immediately dropped it. In an instant, flames burst around him. The fire caught onto the trees and bushes around him, and before he knew it, he was surrounded by fire. The silhouettes of police cars were visible through the flames as he backed away into the forest around him. He looked around, but his vision was blurred. His heart was pounding, and he closed his eyes for a moment. This was it. This was the end. Toby felt a hand on his shoulder. He opened his eyes and looked over to see a large white hand with long bony fingers resting on his shoulder. He followed the arm that was attached to the hand up to a dark towering figure. It appeared to be wearing a dark black suit, and its face was completely blank. It towered over Toby's small frame as it looked down on him. Tendrils reached out from its back. Before Toby knew it, his vision blurred and he heard the sound of ringing in his ears. Everything went blank. That was it. That was the end. That was how Toby Rogers died. A few weeks later, Connie sat in her sister's kitchen. His sister, Lori, sat next to her, drinking a cup of coffee. About 3 weeks ago, Connie lost her husband and her son, and a few weeks before, she had lost her daughter to a car crash. Since then, she moved in with her sister. The police were keeping her busy. They had just finished cleaning up the case, and the story had been released 2 weeks ago. The focus of the world seemed to have shifted to completely new stories. Lori switched the TV on to a news broadcast. On the TV, the news reporter began introducing the new headline. We have breaking news. Last night there have been reported the murder of 4 individuals. There are no suspects yet, but the victims were a group of middle school kids who had been out in the woods late last night. The kids had been bludgeoned and stabbed to death. The investigators have discovered a weapon at the crime scene. It appears to be an old dull blade hatchet, as you can see here. The picture changed to show snapshots of the weapon exactly as it was left at the crime scene. Investigators have pulled the name of a possible suspect, Toby Rogers, a 17-year-old boy who stabbed his father to death a few weeks ago and tried to cover up his escape by setting a fire in the streets and forest area around a neighborhood. Although they believed the young boy had died in the fire, investigators suspect Rogers might still be alive due to the fact that his body was never found. Ooh, I don't know about you guys, but I just got some chills reading that one. And oh my god, I'm looking, I didn't realize that this last bit was 45 minutes long that we've been recording. Excuse me, I'm sick right now. Well, I'm getting over my sickness right now. Man, that was a good read. I remember reading that as a kid, but like, you know, when it's been so long since you've read a story, you forget about it. Whew. Yeah, that was a long one. But as I said before, that's going to go ahead and be the end of the episode today. But before we end, I'd like to go ahead and shout out the city that has been listening the most. It's going to be California and the U.S., Santa Ana, as usual. And then tied with Santa Ana, California is going to be Houston, Texas. I do have family out in Houston, Texas, so thank you guys for watching. And thank you everyone else for watching. I'm kind of looking on here, noticing most of just some other like little analytics for y'all. 38% of y'all listen to me using Apple Podcasts. 33% of y'all use Spotify. 9% use Podbean. 4% use CastBox. And 16% of y'all use other podcast streaming services. And this is actually kind of surprising. 42% of y'all listen to me on your iPhones. 25% on Android and 4% on smart speaker, I don't judge, and 30% on other devices. But I am tired, y'all. It is currently 6 in the morning. I'm about to go to bed. If you guys want to check out the two stories I just read for yourselves, go ahead and look at the description. I'll be including the links in there. And if you want to check us out more and get an idea of what I'm going to post and stuff like that, check out the Facebook page at the Dark Cryptids Podcast. I also have an Instagram page as well. Same thing, the Dark Cryptids Podcast. With the Instagram page, I don't really post on there, but if you message me on Instagram or Facebook, I will get back to you within 24 to 48 hours. And once again, as I've mentioned in previous episodes, if y'all have any suggestions on anything you want me to read, any ideas, comments, or just some feedback for me, let me know, because that's the only way I can improve. But thank you again, everyone, for listening tonight, and thank you guys for continued support as always. I hope you guys have an amazing night, a good weekend, and a wonderful new year. Stay spooky, y'all.